I'd like to call April 13th Senate Resources Committee to order. Members present are Senator Guest, Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator Seekins, and myself, Senator Wagoner, Chair. The first bill we will take up today is Senate Bill 53. The title of this bill is Alaska Peninsula Oil and Gas Lease Sale and Taxes. Ms. Jackson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Senator Wagoner, Chair of this committee, and I'm aide to this committee. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 53 has been heard before in this committee once, and the purpose in bringing it before you again is to let you know that the companion measure on the other body's House Bill 71, and it's making its route and heading this direction. There's also Mr. Mark Myers with the Division of Oil and Gas, who should be here shortly, I think, but I believe he was more interested in testifying on Senate Bill 163 anyway. The companion measure, when it was last brought before a committee, had amendments for credits in the Nanana Basin, and that's an issue that this committee dealt with when we had the joint committee with the House and the Resources, House and Senate Resources Committee and Senate Finance on the end of March, it was March 30th. So those are issues that you've had before you. The second amendment is for Healy. There's been some amendments made for the Healy Basin. Those are brand new. The third amendment that has been made is for the Cook Inlet Basin, and the amendment is structured to be the bill that is next before you, Senate Bill 163. So the point of bringing this to your attention was to let you know that all of these are coming. Senator Wagoner's intention is to hold Senate Bill 53 in this committee so that House Bill 71 comes across, and that will be the bill that will be in front of you to work on. That's it, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions, committee? This time we'll take public hearing on public testimony on Senate Bill 53. I don't see anybody online. So is there anybody off net or online that we don't have a record of that wants to testify on this bill? Hearing none. Anybody in Juneau that wishes to testify? All right. This time I'll close the public hearings on Senate Bill 53. We're going to set the bill aside, waiting for legislation to come over from the House then. Next item before us is Senate Bill 163, this Cook Inlet Oil and Gas Tax Credit Bill. And at this time, I'll ask Ms. Jackson to come back to the table. You might as well stay there, Mary. And ask Mark Myers to come to the table at this time, too, if you would, please.
That's where the other chair went. It's up there.
And would you lead the presentation off, Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is...
Just a minute. Please let the record note that Senator Elton is about to join us. Thank you. Go ahead, Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, my name is Mary Jackson, and I'm staff to the chairman and to this committee. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 163 extends credits that were provided in 2003. They were exploration incentive credits under then Senate Bill 185. The credits that were extended, frankly, did not end up applying or being able to apply to the Cook Inlet region because of the narrow constraints in the Cook Inlet region. Three members of this committee, yourself, Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, and Senator Stedman, went to Kenai in February 11th, and attended the joint House and Senate Resources Committee meeting that was held there. And at that hearing, there were a number of testimonies that were given on necessary enhancements in Cook Inlet. So the chairman, when we got back, instructed me to work with the gentleman sitting next to me in an attempt to come up with some credits that would apply to the Cook Inlet, that would make sense, and that were credits that they would be able to work within. And so we've done that. Basically, the three-mile distinction, I'm sorry, if you note, there's a map that was handed out for the Cook Inlet region, and that was provided by the department. What the old bill was 3 miles. If you could drill a well, and if it was the next well was greater than 3 miles, then you get exploration credits, incentive credits. If it was outside of 25 miles from the first drill, then you could get a second 20%. None of it fits the Cook Inlet, and you can see that very clearly when you look at this. Senate Bill 163 took the 3 mile and said it must be within the 3 miles for the first 20%, and it would be outside of 10 miles for the second 20%. And as you can see by this map, even the 10 mile is too big, and there's going to be very little that would be applicable there. And Mr. Chairman, I think I'll stop there. And I'm sorry, two more things that we did. We said that the credits had to be applied for by the producer, by the explorer, and that the department, the commissioner, had 60 days to respond, yay or nay, rather than an after-the-fact resolution and find out the answer was no. The second thing that we did, and I should say there that the consideration was 30 days, 60 days, or 90 days, and we split it in the middle, and the department would probably like 90. So, the second thing that we did was to cap it at $20 million at maximum for the credits, that was for the full length of the period. 2010 is the time frame, and a maximum of $20 million. So the fiscal note is $20 million over that term. And that's it, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions of Ms. Jackson? Did a good job, Mary. Senator Elton, you always have a question.
Well, no, I think your staff might want to pass this to the department, too. I mean, I'd be interested in some discussion of how much of an incentive may be needed with oil and gas prices at the current levels.
I'm going to pass that to the department.
why don't we let Mr. Meyer go ahead and give whatever presentation he wants on this bill, and then he could answer that question. How's that? Okay. Thank you, Mark. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mark Myers, Director of the Division of Oil and Gas and Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. In this particular credit, the chairman asked what could be done in the incentive to make it efficient for Cook Inlet. And with Cook Inlet, there are a large number of wells that have been drilled, but there are still some legitimate exploration targets that have not been explored for. And the earlier tax EIC used a mechanical mechanism. It said a well was defined as an exploration well via its distance from other wells. And that's only really one test you could apply. Again, it's a pretty artificial test. It's mechanical. It has advantages in that it's simple, but it may be irrelevant to the geological and economic risk taken on by a producer or an explorer. When you look at geological targets in Cook Inlet, a lot of these are in deeper horizons near existing infrastructure, but they're no less risky geologically than a frontier or wildcat in the sense of the geologic risk, because it could be a totally unexplored area. In particular, in the deeper parts of the basin in Cook Inlet, there is potential in the Jurassic section that's below the traditional producing horizons. Also, as you move away from that infrastructure, there could be fault-separated trapping mechanisms and stuff that have not been explored. And again, these are geologically as risky as a frontier exploration play. So the question was, in a basin that's relatively mature, a lot of the plays have been drilled, but there's still some existing plays. What do we need to do to help incentivize those? Recognizing the mechanical 3 mile distance criteria really doesn't define an exploration play. And that there still are many viable exploration plays in the inlet less than 3 miles, but have not yet been drilled despite the higher oil prices and despite the available infrastructure. So again, this presupposes then that we use a geological test, that a company would come to the Department of Natural Resources, make their case, show us their seismic and well data they're basing their play on, or their geological and geophysical data otherwise, and the commission would predetermine, is it distinctly separate? Is it a separate target? Or is it, in fact, just a development well or delineation well of an existing discovery? If they can demonstrate that, in fact, it is geologically distinct or reasonably estimated with the data to be geologically distinct, the commissioner would pre-certify that they would be eligible for the credit for their well. So they would have the certainty ahead of time to go ahead and then get the 20% credit or 40% credit if they're outside of the 10-mile distance from units. So the thought was, instead of using a mechanical 3-mile standard, use a geologically based standard, base it on the information presented to the commissioner to make his decision ahead of time with his discretion to say yes or no, it is distinctly separate. So that would, we thought, help encourage exploration in the inlet. In particular, why is exploration expensive in the inlet? Largely because, particularly in the offshore areas, you have no equipment to do it. You need to bring in very expensive jackup rigs to do it, or you have to use highly deviated wells from existing platforms or infrastructure. Both are pretty expensive propositions, and the size of the potential accumulations are relatively small remaining. Again, the more mature basin, many of the obvious plays have been drilled, leaving the more risky, deeper zones, or potentially smaller targets. So this incentive on the exploration front should help improve the odds of getting investment within the Cook Inlet. Capping the credits gives you an absolute limit to how much exposure you do have with this program. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd answer any questions. With Senator Elton's question, I think it's a fair question. I think in reality, what we're seeing again is the larger independents and the majors are basically just producing. There's a couple of exploration plays are playing in, but they see the inlet as a relatively mature asset. So we're looking at smaller independent companies. I think those companies are typically less capitalized up front. So again, exploration costs would help assist in their drilling relatively expensive wells, or help bringing in the jackup rig or other infrastructure needed to drill in the offshore areas. So again, I think the credit would probably be applicable and help. Capping it at a set amount, I guess, limits the downside potential if it's not right. I don't know if I answered your question, Senator Elton.
Senator Elton.
There is no perfect answer because it's highly speculative, of course. Second question, Mr. Chair. I mean, what's the status of the shallow gas leases in the southern Kenai Peninsula, and would this credit apply, be applicable there on those leases?
Senator Elton to the chair. There's no restriction on these credits as to what land in Cook Inlet they would apply. So any well that would be drilled that would meet the qualification, either be 3 miles away or be distinctly separate target, would qualify. If you were drilling coal bed methane wells, for example, and I don't think the Southern Kenai are that play, but they were a coal bed methane, you'd probably get credit for one well, and everything else in the coal seams then would not qualify because they wouldn't be distinctly separate targets. If they're conventional gas plays, it would be on a case-by-case basis, and they probably would apply. As far as the status is, the clock is ticking. I think they have about a year left on them. We have seen no activity and no permitted activities on those leases, so it's highly unlikely that we will see activity. You can never say never, but again, I believe it's highly unlikely at this point in time.
Senator Seekins.
Basically, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Basically, Mr. Myers is here. Pretty much commented on what my comment would be, but in terms of risk, a dry hole still is a dry hole no matter what the price of oil is.
Further questions of either Ms. Jackson or Mr. Myers on this bill?
Let's go to Lisa Parker in Kenai.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Lisa Parker and I'm with Agrium. Agrium appreciates the efforts that the Alaska legislature is doing to spur oil and gas exploration and development here in Cook Inlet. With respect to the bill before you, have a couple of comments. One, in section one, as the bill is drafted, this revision would apply to activity only that is conducted after July 1 of this year, and didn't know if this was the intent or if this was a typing error. Then later on in section 4, with respect to the $20 million limit, with the five-year program in Cook Inlet with a $20 million limit, this would mean that you would probably be able to drill five or six wells that would be able to take and utilize this program where there was an offshore well, probably one. If the intent is to encourage further exploration, you might want to re-examine this $20 million limit. One additional note on the incentive programs in general. The programs as they are still contain the usual exclusions which diminish the attractiveness of the incentive programs. These exclusions include administration, supervision, engineering, geological management, and the environmental costs, all of which are significant components and reduce the effective incentive from 20% to around 10%. With the incentive being at the discretion of the commissioner and usually decided after the work is incurred, potentially these will have little impact on an oil company's economics. With those comments, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee members might have.
Thank you, Lisa. First, that is a date that we wanted in the bill. It wasn't a mistake, July 1. Second, as to the $20 million, we needed a figure to put in there, and if $20 million gets us started and we see enough activity, we can revisit that figure. That's nothing that's we're not capable of increasing, but at this time, I think the $20 million laying out there gives some certainty to a lot of people that sometimes question an open-ended incentive. So that gives us some comfort level of some control on the amount of money that is available, and at the same time, we can parlay that out with what happens with the development. Are there any other questions of Ms. Parker? Okay, thanks, Lisa.
Thanks, Senator.
Next is from the Department of Revenue, Dan Dickerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of the comments I've made would just echo those already made by Mark Myers and Mary Jackson. I won't go through the bill again, but fundamentally this is a production tax credit. Mark clearly pointed out it would be more attuned to what's going on in Cook Inlet to where the density of work that's already occurred makes the limits established in 2003 less useful. Our only comment, and this kind of gets to one of the things that Ms. Parker brought up, is that if the $20 million limit is in there, and I think when she said there was one well, I think she wasn't thinking through the credit. I mean, at $20 million, if every well gets a 20% credit, that implies $100 million of well work, which is certainly more than one well. But we should certainly clarify who gets it, because near the end, we don't want folks running in and sort of who gets through the door first for that last well. So there may be clear as to what happens near the end if there is more than one exploration project out, let's say only $50,000 worth of credit ready to hand out. But with some technical work on that, we think this is a good way of making this more appropriate for cooking. And with that, I'm certainly welcome to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Dickerson? Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, we'll come back to Juno. Is there, Fred, hand me those papers right there. Yeah, please. Is there anybody here in Juno? I'm sorry, wait a minute. We have one other person in Kenai. Mike Munger, are you on there, Mike?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair. I'm here today, though, to speak to SDR number 6.
Oh, okay. You don't want to talk to us?
Actually, I'd love to talk to you.
All right. We'll be with you in a minute then, Mike. Is there anyone here in Juneau who wishes to testify? Since there's nobody in Juneau, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to set this bill aside. And we'll go to next to SCR 6.
Good
Go ahead, Ms. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Mary Jackson. These two resolutions that are coming before you are also part of the results of the meeting that took place in Kenai in February. The abandonment of the platforms in the Cook Inlet is a serious issue, and it's one that's been raised and talked about off and on, as far as we could tell, since 1996. And it's a very difficult issue. It's not an easy one to address, and that is in part probably why it hasn't been addressed. But this resolution requests the governor, urges the governor to go forward and ask the department to actually promulgate the regulations. There was some question at one point of whether or not the Department of Natural Resources or the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission had precedence over that, and apparently the department does. So, Mr. Chairman, the department is here to talk to you about it, and I believe also online is the commissioner from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
Mr. Myers, would you come up at this time and give us your feelings on this resolution?
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Mark Myers, Director, Division of Oil and Gas. The issue around the potential abandonment of the Cook Inlet platforms is a really big deal. First of all, we have to recognize these platforms have been there, most of them, for a long time, with the exception of the Osprey platform. Many of them are nearing their mature end of life, and others have actually been lighthoused or partially abandoned. It's a very important issue. It involves a lot of stakeholders, folks like have to worry about the issues of navigability, DEC that has to worry about pipeline abandonment, AOGCC that has to worry about downhole abandonment, DNR that has to worry about potential removal of the facility. Should they be removed? What conditions should the environment be brought back to? The lease requires full abandonment, full removal, and back to original condition. Are there better or higher uses for these platforms? Who retains the liability at the point of abandonment? What's acceptable abandonment? The state has historically relied on parent company guarantees under the lease to require the company to bring it back into full abandonment and the deep pockets of the original lessee. So it's not a liability you can sign away. And so that's a very strong incentive, again, a very strong protection in the process. We're well aware that some of these platforms may have extended life if smaller operators can take over the platforms and operate them at lower costs and lower overhead. And we expect that to happen. That, in fact, has happened as in the resolution with Cross Timbers. And we've had some good operators come back in. We want to make sure, though, that any operator comes back in, that we're fully protected on the liability. With all that said, that liability becomes an issue when folks want to sell the platforms. And so they are entitled to some certainty about how, in fact, and what standard the state's going to hold the lessee to. So in the end, we fully need a process. We need a series of regulations about how we deal with these things. And quite honestly, since statehood, really, we haven't gone through full abandonment of these platforms. So we're in a new territory. We expect to hold a full set of procedures this year on this issue. But until we have our act together, until we have all the participants at the table, all the stakeholders involved, we haven't been prepared to do it. This urges us to do it. We recognize, in fairness to all parties, we need to do it. And we recognize there are a lot of stakeholders involved and that we are the lead agency. So we support the resolution, but we recognize it's a very large, daunting task. And we would not expect to enter it until probably about the fall. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions of Mr. Myers?
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. Next, let's go to Anchorage, to Dan Seamont. Good morning. Good afternoon, Dan.
Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
You bet.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dan Seamount, and I'm one of the three commissioners of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. We're looking at this resolution from the aspect of conservation of resources, and we welcome the opportunity to testify on SCR number 6. The resolution addresses the subject of abandonment of existing Cook Inlet offshore platforms and would promote an assessment of the potential utility of these platforms in supporting future oil and gas exploration and development. The AOGCC fully supports this goal. There's a lot of oil and there is potential for undiscovered oil within reach of these platforms. First of all, there is still a lot of oil left in the known reservoirs. Recovery of the original oil in place has been relatively low off a number of these platforms, less than 30%, compared to other fields such as Prudhoe Bay with recoveries of greater than 50% of the original oil in place. We believe that there are hundreds of millions of barrels of oil left in the produced fields of Cook Inlet in known reservoirs. We've been motivated and energized production companies such as Cross Timber should be encouraged to use new technology to recover more of the known oil. That's the oil that's reachable from the platforms. Also, there's exploration potential left within reach. There are fewer than 300 exploration wells and 1,000 total wells that have been drilled the entire history of the 10,000 square mile basin. I've done work in the Rocky Mountains in similar sized basins such as the San Juan Basin of New Mexico, which at this time has 29,000 wells and where they're still making discoveries. Leslie Magoon, who's a USGS expert geologist and geochemist, has concluded that only 4% of the total oil generated in Cook Inlet Basin has ever been found. We don't know yet if the missing oil has escaped to the surface or still trapped in undiscovered oil fields or both, but there's a lot of oil that has not been accounted for yet. There's numerous, as Mark Myers was saying, there are untested fault blocks within reach, and there's other exploratory prospects that have been identified by many petroleum explorationists over the last 50 years. Possibly the highest potential play is the pre-tertiary Cretaceous and Jurassic rocks that we've been hearing about lately in the news and Mr. Myers mentioned. The Jurassic rocks is where almost all the oil was generated. To date, only 55 wells have been drilled into this section, and most have been drilled only to the very top. Little is known of its productive potential. We feel the existing offshore platforms represent viable infrastructure, and it makes sense to re-enter their idle well bores and deepen or sidetrack to test the pre-tertiary section, 5,000 foot extra depth below the tertiary is an arbitrary number, but it would probably come close to fully evaluating the pre-tertiary section's potential. You can also drill out to see the new fault blocks and the other prospects before abandoning the platforms. As I've alluded to, there are four tiers of potential that are within reach of the platform. There's the unproduced oil in known reservoirs, there are new fault blocks, there are many identified exploration prospects, and there's the pre-tertiary play. These plays would most likely be uneconomic and unreachable if it were not for these existing platforms. Our new commissioner, Kathy Forrester, pointed out to me she's got a lot of experience on the North Slope, and Mr. Chairman, you'll be talking to her on Monday when she comes down. She pointed out to us that the situation at Cook Inlet is analogous to that of the North Slope, where ConocoPhillips and BP are already using idle well bores on existing pads to deepen or sidetrack for small accumulations of reservoirs that would be uneconomic if not for the existing infrastructure. In other words, it's possible that Cook Inlet has already been shown to be successful by the success on the North Slope. We feel the platform should be viewed as assets, and we recommend that all stakeholders be very careful when considering abandonment and do everything they can to have all the potential oil and gas reserves tested before abandonment. There's a window of opportunity right now to capture additional reserves. Platform abandonment would close that window. Once the window closes, much of the state's resources and Cheadock Peninsula's economic potential could be lost. And with that, I'm open to questions, Mr. Chairman.
Are there questions of Mr. Seamount? Did a good job, Dan, and no questions. One thing I like to add to your presentation, when you talk about the economic viability of the Cook Inlet, There are currently a little over 300 jobs directly related to those platforms in Cook Inlet still. So it's a very important part of the overall oil and gas economy that we have based in Cook Inlet right now. So I appreciate your time and your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we'll go to Mike Munger in Kenai.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Hi, Mike.
My name for the record is Michael Munger. I'm the Executive Director of the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, or CIRCAC, which is a nonprofit corporation organized exclusively for the oversight, monitoring, assessment, and evaluation of oil spill prevention, safety, and response plans, terminal and oil tanker operations, and environmental impacts of oil tanker and oil terminal operations in Cook Inlet. I'm here today to inform the committee that CIRCAC has very similar interest in the Cook Inlet platform removal. One of our many projects was to take a detailed look at the aspects of what we call DR&R, which is dismantlement, removal, and restoration of the Cook Inlet offshore production platforms. One of the most interesting revelations that's come out of our research on the subject is that DNR has no specific statutes or regulations governing the lessee's DNR&R obligations. Rather, DNR will determine the leaseholder's ultimate DNR&R obligations on a case-by-case basis based on the individual circumstances of each site. SCR 6 will ultimately address this concern by directing the DNR to develop these regulations. This will have numerous benefits for the regulators, the regulated community, and the stakeholders of Cook Inlet. The white paper we have developed, which has had input from various federal and state agencies, including DNR, oil producers, and stakeholders, will be ready for full release in May. The paper is a compilation of our research into this issue. We'd be willing to share this with any interested parties, as we do with all our programs and projects. Thanks for the opportunity to address the committee on this subject today.
Thanks for your testimony, Mike. Are there questions, Mike? I see no questions. Appreciate you taking the time to testify.
Thank you.
I don't think there's anybody else on off-net or close the hearing on online and off-net. Is there anyone in Juneau who wishes to speak on this resolution? Seeing none, I'll close public hearing. There is an amendment we need to have offered. Senator Guest.
Chair, I'd move amendment number one that's in front of the members on the green sheet. It, for the record, page 2, line 6, it removes the word smaller and inserts growing independent.
Reads much better.
I think they would appreciate it.
Much more professional. Is there any objection?
Well, just objection, I guess, for a question.
Senator Elton?
I understand independent. Is growing limiting? I mean, does this mean if they're not growing? I don't mean to be a wordsmith, but.
I don't know. It may be a little bit of a play on words.
Mr. Chairman.
Here we go. Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This paragraph references XTO Energy, and they're really no longer in a smaller bracket. So they're a growing independent company. That's why we changed it.
And I'll speak technically, they are. They have become quite a large independent since they took over the Shell platforms that we went on.
Mr. Chair, I'm comfortable with however you want to do it. I just don't want to be in a position if they have a bad quarter, they're no longer growing, and we're no longer talking about them.
They're growing pretty much worldwide, believe it or not. So, okay. Is there? Do you remove your objection? Okay. The chair would entertain a motion to move this.
Mr. Chairman, I move
resolution.
Move Senate concurrent resolution number 6 from committee with individual recommendations. And no fiscal note.
Amended.
As amended.
As amended.
Thank you, Senator Seekins. Where's the book? Is that blue one there? Six. There we go. Got Fred put to work. Next item before us today is SCR 7, Oil and Gas Regulatory Revision. Ms. Jackson will make the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, Mary Jackson with Senator Wagner's staff and aide to this committee. And again, this resolution was a continuing from the Kenai meeting. And Mr. Chairman, it's kind of if I may speak bluntly, this looks pretty fluff, but as a practical matter, probably the most compelling testimony that was given at the February meeting was from a gentleman named Mr. Uhlhoven, James Uhlhoven, who began work in the Cook Inlet oil fields in the late 1960s, and his argument was straight up, and it was, don't make the first hurdle so big that the new kid won't try to take the hurdle. And so this resolution is just to applaud the efforts that have been made to streamline and to ensure that those efforts are continued. Internally, we just kind of called this the Uhlhoven resolution.
Okay. Can we have Mark come back up to the table then?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Mark Myers, Director of Oil and Gas and State Geological Survey. And again, we are always looking at ways to do what's in this joint concurrent resolution. So again, we don't have any stress with it at all. We recognize there's always better ways to streamline the process, and in the goal of streamlining the process, not dilute the value of the process or not dilute input into the process, but eliminate overhead and duplication. With that, Mr. Chairman, I answer any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Myers? And I would state that yesterday we did have a hearing pertaining to this resolution, to another resolution, and RCA seems to be much more amenable to working at a faster rate on hearings of importance such as the SIGS line. That's what we had the hearing on yesterday. And they have accelerated the hearings on that line to where most parties that are involved in that hearing are very, very happy with it. So they will get it over, in fact. So it has had some effect already, and hopefully they will continue that way. It seems like Ms. Guyard is very, very conscious of schedules and what it does to hold down development and everything. So I was happy to hear her attitude on that. Are there questions of the committee? Senator Seekins?
Just for my own benefit, Mr. Chairman, the first whereas says that there's been an enhanced attractiveness of exploration, production, and development. Can I get a couple of examples of what we could look at in terms of results there? It says has this enhanced attractiveness. Are there any results from the attractiveness? Or? Mr. Myers?
Senator Seekins to the chair. I think we have some outstanding examples, particularly in the Beaufort Sea. A company called Armstrong Resources came up here. They bought leases and within 4 months had their permits to drill in the Beaufort Sea, which is usually one of the hardest places to permit because of the environmental issues, because of the remoteness of location, and because of concerns over subsistence resources. They have developed good working relationships with the North Slope Borough. The process went very quickly. Kerr McGee followed suit. They were out there last winter with two separate rigs, and again this winter with two separate rigs drilling. These are companies that are brand new to Alaska. They came up. They worked well with the local communities. They worked well with the streamlined permitting process. They're buying leases or acquiring leases, and within a year, they are drilling exploration wells on them in areas that have traditionally been difficult to permit in. I think another example is we've learned that for the permitting process to work, the local communities have to be able to support it. We have to work through the issues with the communities. This site, again, a few nights ago, we're preparing for a lease sale in Bristol Bay Area. We have our group people out there working with the communities, going through the finding process. So by not shortcutting the process up in the front, by following full community involvement in the process, there's a full understanding of what's going to happen if you go to the permitting and development process. Expectations are there. There's trust built between the agencies and the local folks. It all works better. So again, by doing this, you're not shortcutting the process, you're streamlining it, but there is intensive personnel capital and time capital up front to make this work, to develop those relationships, to develop the standards, that when you put the standards in up front, that you really have looked at the development situations, you look at the environment, you put the adequate protections in. So that upfront work, I think we're doing in Alaska Peninsula, I'm particularly proud of it. It's an example. We've got support from all three borough governments and from the Native community there as well. So by doing that, when we look forward, if we're successful with the lease sale, we're successful with exploration, permitting will be a lot easier because you've gone in there with the full support of the local community.
Senator Seekins?
I could. Just looking at this from standpoint of a legislator, has any of this been with the cooperation of the legislature, or has it all been through incentives that were initiated by the administration?
Senator Seekins to the chair, the legislature has funded some positions. They supported, again, the change in the movement of program offices like Coastal Zone Management into the Department of Natural Resources. They've provided funding for on a case-by-case basis for project coordinators. They supported budget increases at times for agencies like DEC in critical areas. So I think the legislature, through its budgetary process and then through some of the changes of habitat and the coastal zone moving into a single agency, has done a lot to do the process. So I think it's truly been a joint effort. And again, you allowed me to hire several new permitters that have been and best interest finding writers and folks to work through the processes. And having those folks on staff has been critically important.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I don't have any problem giving the governor a pat on the back for what he does, but I'd also think that it would be very worthwhile to recognize the efforts of the legislature in this resolution. And rather than saying that I would blanketly endorse the ongoing efforts, because I don't know what they all are, I would certainly encourage them.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments or questions? I might add one thing just for everybody's own information. We had a meeting yesterday in my office with another company who is a fairly good-sized independent that's getting ready to drill another well in the Beaufort Sea. 4 foot of water, is that right, Mark? Do you want to cover that a little bit? You probably know more about it than I do.
Well, we have several wells now. The Iapetus well that was being drilled by ConocoPhillips was drilled offshore, directionally offshore. We have Kerr McGee with multiple wells. We have Pioneer looking at development. And then we have another potential well to be shallowly drilled off the Point McIntyre area as well. I think that's the well you're referring to.
Pioneer, the ones I was talking to, are they not now building their own drill rig also? They're in the process of having one built for them?
They are, Mr. Chairman, a more fit-to-purpose, lighter weight, more mobile rig. Pioneer is not actively drilling this year, but they're assessing sanctioning a development project from their earlier successful drilling out there about 2 years ago.
So it's interesting. We have Independence coming to Alaska, and now they're having their own drill rigs built because of the unavailability of drill rigs in Alaska. So I just wanted to give them kind of an attaboy.
Want to move this?
Yeah, let's see. There's, I don't think there's, is there anyone online or off net to testify on this resolution? There is none. How about here in Juneau? See none. What's the, I'm going to close public hearings at this time. It's the wish of the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seekins.
I move SCR number 7 from committee with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
Any objection? Okay, that resolution will move. With that Friday schedule, we have HB 19, pesticide and broadcast chemicals, and Senate Bill 164, salmon product development tax credit. And with that, we're adjourned.